I want you to imagine the future in motion where all cars are green, bicycles rule, and public transit is fast, frequent, and fun. It's a world where mobility is sustainable and accessible to everyone, where energy is clean and abundant, renewable and affordable, where communities aren't just smart, they're intelligent and nurturing places to live. So come along and explore that world with me on this EV World Future in Motion podcast.
Hello, I'm Bill Moore, the publisher of EVWorld.com, and we're about to explore the future in motion. Today, my guest is Ashish Kumar. Ashish is the CEO of Zunum. And I'll probably murder that too, Ashish. Arrow.
Oh, no, that's perfect. That's
good,
perfect.
Good. Located in Seattle, Washington. And we want to talk about the aircraft, the electric hybrid aircraft that his company is developing. So it's a pleasure, Ashish, to have you with us on EV World.
Well, thanks so much, Bill. It's great to be here.
Well, I tell you what, as being a pilot who has all of 140 hours on my logbook, not a lot, and that was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. I'm always curious about what's happening in the aviation field, and particularly now that we're seeing an increased interest in bringing electric power to that. So anyway, I would like to start, if you don't mind. I am always curious about how these things get started. So I'm wondering if you could sort of take us back to the restaurant and the napkin or whatever it was that inspired the launch of Zoom and Arrow.
Yeah, of course. Happy to do that. Well, if you ask my 8-year-old daughter, she would say that she and Matt's, my co-founder's son, Sebastian, are the real founders.
Because it
was they that got together in a playgroup and got the daddies together. So that's actually the founding story, right, of middle-aged entrepreneurs. It often happens through your family, and that's certainly our case. Matt and I got together in the summer of 2013. Matt, at that point, had already spent a couple of weeks working on a hybrid aircraft concept, which is very much like the urban vertical takeoff air taxis that you see a lot of these days.
Right.
And so he approached me, and at that time, I'd had a long, you know, my background is I have a PhD in aerospace engineering. I've been a professor of engineering. I worked at National Lab at Sandia, and then I spent the bulk of my career on the commercial side, some in aerospace, but more in high tech, online media, medical devices across Dell, Microsoft, and Google.
Right.
So I was at that point. I'd actually was involved with 8 different startups. Having decided to take a break from the corporate career, and this was one of them. As I'd done with all of the others, we sort of agreed to roll up our sleeves for a couple of months and generally see where this would go. And in doing that piece of work jointly, we were like, yeah, this urban opportunity is obviously very, very significant, right? But that there is also a much greater opportunity that people have actually seen all the way back to the 1960s, which is regional, which is anywhere from 100 miles to 1,000, 1,500 miles, where, we've relied on technologies that really are optimal for medium to long haul, which
right.
is gas turbines, it's airliners, it's hubs. It goes back to the 60s where people started really raising the question around the need to optimize and build an air system that is really addresses the specific needs of, fast door-to-door regional transport, right? So that's sort of the origin story of our business.
Okay. In addition to my paltry 140 hours of flying, I do have 9 years at Continental Airlines. So I understand.
Yeah.
And my brother actually is an executive with ExpressJet, which is, of course, a regional jet.
Okay, that's
jet
true.
Provider.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
So obviously there's an interest here. So you basically decided that rather than doing the quadricopter type approach, you would look more at this short range to medium range market instead. Of course, yeah, that would require a different kind of aircraft. So how did this sort of design evolve that you're working on now?
Yeah, so we observed that really the market to address is the short-haul market, right? And also we needed to address it with commercial-grade costs, right? That you can't just come in at any old price point. You need to actually come in and get your economics right so operators can make money. And so that is sort of our basic principle, is that an aircraft that will deliver, is capable of doing terrific door-to-door times, can come into small airfields, can be quiet, so communities do not object, and can fly all hours, and then can do it at operating costs that are at airline level or below, right? So that was sort of, so the first part gave us a lot of requirements around the speed, altitude, noise, runway,
right?
So, you know, the aircraft you see is highly optimized for the ranges, right? So it's a 700-mile range aircraft. We expect a lot of those trips to be somewhere short of that. And so the speeds, the altitudes, the pressurization, the cabin layout is really targeted for that, for those type of distances. We also have designed, we designed aircraft everywhere from 6-seat short range to vertical takeoff, to 100-seat, 1,500-mile aircraft, which obviously, 1,500 miles, you're flying faster, you're flying higher, all right? Much more a 20, 25, 20, 30 aircraft. So, you know, so that those are the two pieces that came together. Is on one hand is the requirements, which are very tight, targeted at a specific range that you're targeting, and then the other side of it is the economics, right? That you can't compromise. That if there's something that aviation will tell you, is that you can't be out of cost position on a commercial transport aircraft. If it's not a commercial transport aircraft, you can go crazy, right? But then the market you're addressing is not the mass market.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Now, I saw a figure that your target here is like $260 an hour for the 12-passenger model.
Yeah.
How does that compare with, you know, the most ubiquitous aircraft out there, which, of course, would be the 737 or, you know, somewhere in that same ballpark, you know, an Airbus 320? So how does that sort of, you know, that... Where are they at in the spectrum?
Yeah. So there's two compares, right? One is to a like size aircraft. So if you took our 12 seat and there's a, you know, and the size class, there's a bunch of business jets and turboprops that are roughly the same size. And they would run anywhere from 4 to, 6 times more expensive power, right? So,
oh, okay.
You know, 2,500 to $2,500 an hour is not too expensive for a business jet, right? So you're taking that cost down by a factor of 10.
Right.
So it's very, very significant. The compare against airline obviously is a tough compare, right? Because you're doing it against 250 passengers. But where it gets tricky is that a lot of the quoted numbers are not for 500 miles, right? I mean, those are 3,500 nautical mile aircraft. So
right.
When they talk about operating costs, they're really talking about something above 1,000 mile. So the metric there is different, right? It is really cost per passenger mile. And
right.
We are targeting 8 cents a passenger mile operating costs. And this is The Economist and the Financial Times noted that the entire U.S. mainline fleet last year did 11 cents a passenger mile.
So even with the longer haul, the advantage of the longer haul and stacking more people in the aircraft, that's you're still coming in at a below the
but
cost.
But this is operating costs. Yeah,
yeah,
this is, again, operating costs doesn't include crew,
right.
Doesn't include depreciation, right? So once you factor that in, it changes. But, you know, the 11 cents is a blend, right? So on that is everything they fly. They do fly a lot of short stages. So it's got the shorter distances tend to be, a 737 will do below 8 cents a mile on long haul. On short haul, it will do more.
Right.
And, that 11 cents is kind of a blend. because it's just gotten actuals and it's pulling in even the turboprops and other things that the commercial carriers. But yeah, so our goal is to be in the ballpark because, you know, we've been talking to operators now for 3 or 4 years and, you know, I think we have a pretty good sense for what cost levels they can build businesses around the platform, right? And fly against a larger one.
Well, let's talk about, you talk about the carriers that you've spoken to. Interestingly, I mean, it's one thing to have a great idea inspired by your 8-year-old. it's another to get the money to take that idea from, you know, a napkin or envelope into, you know, hiring people and setting up an office and, you know, all that goes along with, you know, getting an idea off the ground, literally. How did you get Boeing and JetBlue, I think, involved in this?
Yeah. So I think, I mean, and Bill, you cover all segments of EVs, right? And, as you know, the bulk of venture capital for early stage companies out there, I think it's like 92% plus of all venture capital in early stage companies is really focused on software.
Yeah,
you know, it just doesn't. Folks just don't like hardware. In doing this journey, I spend actually a bunch of time, probably 10, 15 different hardware CEOs, right? Most of them in various forms of clean tech, and you know, they were like, you know, don't waste your time. Or it's kind of a needle in a haystack. It's not saying that they're not interested. You'll have to find, they won't have a shingle out there that says, I do electric aircraft, right? Or I do electric vehicles. It's more around if there is a connection with an individual and if they happen to have LPs that give them leeway to sort of branch out, then you've got, what I learned from all of these other entrepreneurs is if you're doing a hardware venture, especially an aviation venture, there is no cookie cutter approach to raising money. Everyone's going to do it differently because there is nothing established. You kind of have to go test the market and then sort of based on, you know, fate, whatever it is, right, you will come up on our path. So I think probably a year and a half or so into our fundraising activities, we sort of went pretty broad. We decided we're just going to focus ourselves on the strategics on one side and then, you know, really the government, right, which is, you know, one of the few reliable sources for hardware funding. And so that's when, we approached Boeing. I think the first conversations were almost 18 months before we went live with them. The whole process of, getting it in front of the right people,
right,
getting it validated, and then at Boeing at that time didn't have a venture arm. So there was also the internal process within Boeing where they were already on path to do something of that nature. And so the two had to come together for it to turn into an investment. And JetBlue was obviously much faster. That was more like a 6-month run, where we were sort of well in the process with Boeing, and you know, JetBlue was the first in the industry to set up a venture arm, and in this case, place it in the Bay Area, or in the deal flow, and had already identified regional transport as an area that was ripe for disruption. Right, so
yeah,
that was a much more the straightforward process because the organization was in place. They already understood this market, and they had a mechanism to fund us.
Oh, speaking of funding, then you did get the state of Washington had a fund, and you started with $800,000, something like that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so that was if you look in the U.S., there hasn't been a lot of federal funding towards electric aircraft type activities at all. So, you know, we talk about that actually being one of the largest, and we're very grateful to the citizens of Washington for that support. It's under their Clean Energy Fund.
Right.
They stepped up where, you know, we approached many federal agencies, and their view was, it's a pie in the sky, right?
Okay, so have I'm assuming that obviously we're talking about multi-million dollar aircraft, You can't build one of these for $800,000, so you're gonna have to have additional capital. So I'm guessing here that what Boeing and JetBlue have come through with support for this.
Yeah, well, the as you know, in a venture world, you never have money for more than a year or two. If you you typically never have more than 1 year or 18 months run rate, right?
Right.
Yep. You have existing investors, and then you're developing prospective investors, and some combination of those. You're hoping if you time it right, you bring them in before you run out of money, right? So that's sort of the cycle we're in.
Yeah.
because nobody will sign, even if they have an interest in the entire program, they will never give you a blank check. It'll always be staged, right? You deliver, and then based on that delivery, they will go through discrete approval around the next tranche, and then you deliver, and then you go back again for the approval. So sort of that's kind of the cycle we're going through. You raise money, and then you get 3 or 4 months, at least from my standpoint, of quiet just to go execute for a while.
Right.
And then, you start then walking the pavement again. Because it's a time cycle to closing these things.
So I don't imagine that you and Matt are the ones that are. You can't do all of this. You can't design an airplane and go knock on doors and things like that. So I mean, how many people do you have devoted to the project at this point?
Well, we just ran a report the other day. We had, approaching 70 people on the payroll, and we are in 3 centers at this point. We have, our first office was here in the east side of Seattle. We also have a center in Illinois on the western suburbs of Chicago where we do all of our electrical work, the electric power plant. And then we've got a satellite in Indiana that is doing the fan. Because we need a way to go from an electric motor and convert it into propulsive thrust.
Right.
So our full-time headcount is approaching 30, but we've always worked. We are leaning on experts in a very broad set of areas. The aircraft, as I said, the turbo machinery, the fan, the electric machines, power electronics, power systems, controls, batteries. Right. So the way we do that is through having very flexible arrangements for technologists that would like to work with us, right? On site, remote, part time, full time. We are sort of very much a new, a next generation company where we sort of work with loose boundaries.
Right,
so,
exactly.
That way we can tap into a much broader talent pool much more flexibly than an established company would.
Right, exactly. Well, let's talk about the airplane. This is you've got a 6-seat version, which I'm gathering is probably sort of more spacious
business jet
type.
Yeah.
That comes, can be used, developed as a 12-passenger short haul thing, probably competing in the general area of the King Air, I would think. So you've got these particular markets that you're working on, and that obviously dictates what your sort of goals are for this aircraft. So what's the parameter? I did a little research. You're looking, 340 mile per hour, 700 mile range, 80% less noise and emissions, and targeting something like possibly this could be operating out of up to, 5,000 different airports. So kind of... give us kind of a little bit better view of what this thing's capable of doing technically.
Yeah, there's about 39,000 airfields around the world, right?
Okay.
And today, just under 2% of them have commercial service, right? So air, over the last 70 years, given the success of the gas turbine, has... if you look at the regionals, they've gone from where in the 1980s they were flying 20-seat planes to where they're flying narrow bodies, right, or flying 80-seat regional jets or turboprops, right? And there's a huge gap that has created, right, where air used to operate, as I said, the 80s, there were average 20-seat planes. If you scroll it back to the 1960s, or even before the highway system in the U.S., you actually had a regional air system with a lot of mom-and-pop operators connecting small communities all over the country, right? Which is why, in the we have 13,500 AFUs in the country. So we think we are targeting runways under 3,000 feet, right, so that we can come into a very large fraction of these AFUs, right? Many more than five. I mean, the five number comes from, that's about 4,000-something is the set of airports that the federal government recognize, supports in the U.S., right?
Okay.
But then there are, in the U.S. you have 13,000. Worldwide, you have 39,000. So it's a very, very large chunk of airfields, and we'd like to be able to come into those quietly. And the type of missions we are looking at are two, right? One is sort of the city-to-city commute, right, where if you're doing a short journey, let's say from Boston to D.C., or San Francisco to L.A., the overhead of making your way through a hub really kills your door-to-door time, right? So the DOT numbers are that in the U.S., if you're traveling by air under 1,000 miles, you will spend 70% of your time on the ground, driving to a hub, making it. And so that's fine for medium to long haul. That's not okay on a short trip, which is why over the years we drive more and more. Right. There used to be air services that don't exist anymore because the time equation doesn't work. So the first prop is really for city to city travelers, where we can, by avoiding the hubs, you can get to places door to door two times faster, right, or more. So San Francisco to LA door to door would be well over 5 hours, is what people will tell you they budget. But if you fly from, there's about 20 smaller airfields in the Bay Area, and if you took one of those, you could get there in half the time.
Yeah.
Right. The other one is obviously from the city to the city to city, the city to sort of smaller cities or to recreational areas where there used to be services and they don't exist anymore. Or if there are services, they do once a day. San Francisco to Redding, or if you want to fly to Tahoe, right, or here from Seattle to Whistler, I mean, all the best, right? It's 7 or 8 hours, but if you flew, you'd be there in an hour and a half.
Yeah.
So it just changes the equation. But the other one, which is sort of in this, worldwide, you more and more have sort of a rural-urban divide, right, where you have communities that more and more have gotten disconnected from the global economy, right, by not having transport links, and, then it gets harder to attract investment and jobs. And so that, I think, is sort of the other massive opportunity, which is to bring high-speed travel where, in some cases it used to be there but was withdrawn, right? And that is simply smaller aircraft that are cost-effective, where operators can build services to all kinds of small communities, right? Feeders to the hubs or just point-to-point.
Okay. The airplane itself.
Right, and just here in the state of Washington, for instance, we have almost 100 airfields, right? And just, 2, 3, 4 of them get commercial service. And so you've got, communities out east that basically have world-class businesses there in Moses Lake, developing the Mitsubishi Regional Jet, but there's no way to get to both Moses Lake, right?
Yeah.
A beautiful
yeah.
airfield, no service. You've got Quincy with one of the world's lowest electricity rates given hydro, and so you've got these massive data centers for the big internet giants, and guess what? There's no way to get to Quincy, right?
You
drive or take a bus or, you shell out for a private jet. So it's really around how do we let people live where they want to live, and still be part of the global economy.
Well, I think a perfect example of this is my very first trip to China. I took on Canada Pacific, or I think whatever the name of the airline was since then.
Yeah.
And on the way back, we stopped in, the flight was Vancouver, and I had to go from Vancouver to Seattle. And of course, that was this kind of a thing. So I think I was in, a de Havilland something or another that made that little short commute. So I could see where, something like that would be of value. So technically, this is going to be I was a little confused what's going to happen here, that the initial evolution of this as you develop this aircraft is going to start off with the airframe, and you're going to develop that, and that's going to be powered initially by a pair of turboprop engines, and then those will be eventually unducted propellers, and then from that you'll introduce then the ducted fans. Is that sort of the progression that's going to happen with this?
Yeah, no, the well, under our hood, we've got a aircraft program and we've got a power and propulsion program, right? We're developing
right.
an engine, an
right.
electric engine. So they sort of are working, running on parallel paths, right? So the aircraft is much more a traditional aircraft program where we go through and eventually around 2020, we'll have a flying prototype of the aircraft.
Okay.
The power plant is going to do what power plants do today in aviation, where they get hung off existing aircraft and they get tested and they get certified without necessarily ever making, before they ever make it onto the target aircraft. So
right.
that is what would be announced in 2019. We're going to take an existing aircraft, and basically that becomes the test bed for our electric powertrain, and it will certify on that aircraft
okay.
about a year ahead of the airframe and the full aircraft certifying.
Okay, so then at I think what you're looking at is targeting something like 2022 for delivery of the ducted fan, which will be the production version.
Yeah, so the production version will, the first flight of it would be 2020, 2021.
Okay.
With the full blown everything, right? And that will then, you know, take the 2 years or so to go through certification. In the meantime, you are standing up a production facility and putting it through manufacturing cert. The propulsion itself, it's going to go, the flying test bed that will be flying next year is going to go through a progression of being first a propeller, and then, you know, very quickly we'll replace it with a ducted fan. So, yeah, just from a risk reduction standpoint, we don't want to put all the bells and whistles on the aircraft right away.
Right.
So we're going to stage in the componentry, the batteries, the range extender, the turbo generator. And then the quiet propulsor will come on and phases on top of it. And, you know, once you go past the aircraft and you look at the power and propulsion, all of those components take about 12 to 18 months to develop, right, to go from a clean sheet to a prototype. So that part of our engineering effort is really rapid prototyping, that between now and entry to service, that'll go through five different generations of prototypes and be tested extensively. So really, when you're getting an aircraft in 2022, that's very reliable and it's seen, you know, several generations of you know, iteration on you know, improving it for weight, for cost, for reliability before it ever gets to service.
Right, right.
So yeah. So that all of that will happen on. We have a ground test bed already that ran earlier this year in Chicago. And that's the copper bird, and then we'll have the flying test bed, and the two of them basically are going to be clocking between now and 2022, basically, more or less continuously test cycles with increasingly more capable power plants.
Let's talk about the power plant. And I understand what you're going to do. Eventually, you're going to have, what, a single turbo generator located what, amidship on the, or you know, at the in the tail of the aircraft, is that right?
Yeah, that's
okay.
Right. Yeah.
And then that's going to create it's going to be attached to an electrical generator, and the generator then is going to use that to then charge the batteries, which I think I've read is in the wings of the aircraft, and of course then that power
yeah.
ends up going to the electric motor fan ducted fan system.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Just to clarify, we don't design. I mean, we can charge the batteries from the generator if you're in a pinch.
Yeah.
But really, the batteries are designed to be charged off the grid and be discharged in flight to the top of descent.
Okay.
And the generator is feeding the motor directly. So it's a series hybrid.
Okay.
All propulsion is electric. And, you know, this aircraft will be certified that you could get it with the turbo generator, or you could just get it with three battery packs, right, with the turbo generator replaced with a third battery pack. That's why we call it a hybrid to electric aircraft.
Ah, okay.
And we think many operators will come, and they might buy the hybrid version at start. But
right.
5 years later, as batteries improve, they could come back in, and we would just you know, lift out the turbo generator and slot in a third battery pack. Right, that the aircraft will be certified to do that, and will be designed to do that.
What where are we at in terms of the battery technology here to get to that point? Go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, so the batteries is, I think, when we look at our class of applications, which are conventional takeoff aircraft and not vertical takeoff aircraft, we've very consistently said that we are, and the industry is about 5 years behind where batteries are, right? That it's the rest of the system that needs to be matured and brought up to, build aircraft that can use the batteries. So the aircraft we've announced for 2022 could be flying today with batteries that that you have in automotive, right? It won't have the 700-mile range. It would be 650 miles. But it's, pretty darn close, right? And maybe a little more expensive than 8 cents, maybe 10 cents.
Right.
We say we are 5 years behind the batteries. And the actual performance in 2022, 2025, our intent is to use the best batteries that the auto industry is using at those points in time. And the actual performance is then a function of where the batteries are at. But we think we've sort of matched it really well to where we expect things to be for the next 20 years. So, so if we had the aircraft ready today, it would have a performance. And then based on where the batteries are in 2022, it'll have a better performance, which, right now, obviously, we can only forecast.
Right. Where are we at in terms of the pilot shortage? I mean, obviously, this is if you're talking about wanting to significantly increase short haul fleet, we're going to have pilots for them, and we're having pilots retiring at a, lickety split rate here. And of course, then that raises the question, at what point do you see these things becoming pilotless?
Yeah, I mean, those are obviously very good questions. The way we plan our business and talk to investors is we look at the market in two tiers, right? There's the first market, which there is no risk in the sense that these are replacing existing aircraft with ones that will fly cheaper, fly with less emissions and fly quieter, right? So
right. That
is, there's a very large market for that. It's about $1 trillion worth of aircraft that needs replacing where you have pilots already flying them. And then there is the other market that if you roll back time to the 80s and 60s and then going beyond those, right, that as new mobility on the ground comes together and really changes how we look at transport and how we look at car ownership, there's a massive upside besides that, you're going to need a lot of, if you stay at the current course, you're going to need pilots for. So this brings to, there's two answers to the question, right? The pilot shortage has to do with, at the end of the day, with what is the proposition to a pilot in terms of how much it costs them to get trained versus the return on that investment through salary and career progression. And entry-level pilots do not, make enough to pay back the loans, right?
No,
I mean, it's a very sad situation,
yeah.
Right? And some of that reflects the nature of the industry they're in, right? It's where, we all buy air tickets based on price, and that kind of puts a squeeze on the entire chain of that business, right? On the aircraft, on the power plant, and on fuel purchasing. But, very importantly, it puts a squeeze on, what an airline can pay a pilot, right? Because it's starting with us and starting with how we sign those. On one hand, we say, hey, this regional market we are talking about is much less competitive, right? It is not, a small number of carriers flying the same routes with the same equipment, right? This is opening up 5,000, 10,000, 15,000 routes where a whole variety of operators could be. A couple of pilots get together in a small town and say, hey, I see these opportunities and let me go fly them. And nobody else is flying them.
Right.
Right. Right. Where what you could make as a pilot changes. So we think there is that equation that people need to keep in mind, right? That this is just economics that have driven it and the economics of this kind of air transport is different. That said, I mean, as I look back to our conversations with the carriers going back to 3 or 4 years, we did not go to them talking autonomy, but every one of them told us, hey, I can't tell you when it's going to happen, but it is going to happen over the life of the airframe you're designing, so it better be compatible. Otherwise, this aircraft will not be will be obsolete. And so, if you look on our website, we talk about the cockpit being pilot optional.
Yeah.
Right? So we don't know. And we think at entry, it will not be pilot optional. It will have all the bells and whistles. So as that technology gets qualified, we will make sure we are one of the first to deploy it, right, for this class of aircraft.
Right.
And as we look at what's happening on the ground, You know, in the last year or so, the attitudes towards autonomy in aviation have changed dramatically, right? Because when we spoke to pilots 3 or 4 years ago, to carriers, their view was, hey, the technology to do this is already available, right? Most of these long-haul flights are largely flown without a pilot.
Yep.
Right? And the issue really is passenger acceptance.
Yep.
And then you say, well, guess what? All our passengers are now getting used to the idea of autonomy in a much more complex environment, which is driving a car on the ground.
Yep. So how soon do you think between the spread between people getting comfortable with that, autonomous car and an autonomous airplane? A decade?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not the expert, but you look at what's happening in urban vertical takeoff, right? Is a lot of those businesses are making the bet that they will go autonomous pretty quickly, and Google's already testing an autonomous air taxi. Not Google, correction. It's Kitty Hawk, which is Larry Page's venture.
Right.
Is testing autonomous air taxis in New Zealand. Right, and
yeah.
You've got Volocopter that's going to start a service and has done pilot flights in Dubai. So I think this is happening really fast. And behind the scenes, the push amongst the cargo operators is even greater. So I think this is going to happen, much, much faster than people in the industry expect because of, and then there's UAVs, right?
Yeah.
That there is a level of, cost reduction in these automation, the automation of flight that's happening through drones that is eventually going to spill over to, starting with the urban vertical takeoff and then eventually going to spill over to our class of applications. So this is going to move fast. And our intent is to make sure we have the engineering design to be fully compatible, to be ready for that, and that we have the partnerships that enable us to be one of the first ones to deploy.
Well, this brought a thought to mind, just as you were talking about that in the UAVs. I could see that at some point what happens is that there is a central control facility, maybe it's the airport, the airline, are guys sitting at consoles are flying multiple flights. Maybe each guy's tasked with four different flights. And he just simply is monitoring four flights, and they land at slightly different times. And so you could have effectively four planes being controlled by the same person.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. And
I never thought of that.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's essentially that's going to happen in aviation. It's already happened in drones, right? And the military has been doing that for decades now. So it's going to happen in passenger flights. And guess what? It's also happening at airports, right? So increasingly, you're starting to have virtual airports that all you have at the airfield is a bunch of sensors, and then there's people sitting in a shed somewhere far away that are monitoring the screens, the whole variety of sensors to then guide the traffic in. So,
right.
So I think aviation over the next 10, 15 years is going to be quite different. But, in case people get worried, I mean, as what we heard from the operators was actually quite simple. They said, hey, as a first step, I'd like to be able to, my first goal here from autonomy is reliability, that if I can have a remote pilot that is supporting the crew on board, right, that gives me a level of safety that today I can't give my passengers, right? So they talk about a progression that goes from maybe you drop down to a single pilot with a remote takeover capability, which is sort of an example of one of the scenarios you described, that you have a pilot on board and you've got somebody on the ground that is overseeing 8 or 10 flights, and if there is a issue on board, they can then take over and bring the aircraft down safely.
Right.
And then, then you take the next step beyond that. You ask the question, well, is there an opportunity to simplify what it takes to fly the aircraft so you can reduce the training requirements and the cost of training these the pilots on board, right? So you can open up the pool, right, and still support them remotely, right? That's one path. And then there's another path, which, let's say, things like cargo may take sooner, which is, you have autopilot supplemented by a remote pilot.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. I could see at some point where you have a dual job. You have a co-pilot on board who monitors on board the plane, and then when the plane's up in the air, becomes the flight attendant.
No, that's right. Yeah, and that's, yeah. I mean, a lot of people, when they say, you ask the question, what does the pilot on a business jet do, right? They do all of these things, right? They monitor passenger boarding, they monitor baggage, they make sure the aircraft is balanced.
Yeah.
They deal with ATC, and then they fly the plane. And a chunk of that time is on autopilot, right? So we think it's really, you in the moment you throw a bunch of passengers into a cylinder and lock them off for an hour or two, you probably need someone to keep the peace, right?
Yeah.
So there's a whole... Yeah, there's a whole variety of reasons why, you know, just it going totally pilotless. I think it's going to happen, you know, more for on-demand flights. But, you know, once you start putting in groups of passengers together and there's all this other paraphernalia you need to do around getting people on board and making sure they have a comfortable flight, that, you know, you sort of, you're like, yeah, there is a different set of functions that the individual may do, which may include flying, but, you know, flying in a much more simplified format.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, you have been extremely generous with your time today. I hadn't planned on going this long, but this is obviously an area that I have a keen amount of interest in. So, Ashish, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And I wish you, you know, much continued success with it. I look forward to... sitting as an amateur, maybe in the right hand seat,
or on the ground and flying it, right?
Yeah, exactly. So. There we go. Okay, very good. Thank you, sir.
You've been listening to an EV World Future in Motion podcast with Bill Moore. For more information on the world of electric vehicles, subscribe to EVWorld.com. This has been an EVWorld.com Incorporated audio production.